All right, well, thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to speak. So I'm going to tell you about constraints on dark matter models from a Fermi-Ladd analysis that I was involved with. In particular, my two co-authors, Francesco Loparco and Nicola Mazziotta. And this talk is on behalf of the Fermi-Ladd collaboration. So I'm actually in the really interesting situation of presenting the results of an analysis, the motivation for which was worked out in large part by a large number of people in this room. So I'm going to do my very best to cite everyone. If I've missed you, please forgive me and let me know afterwards. I'd be happy to add you next time. All right, so let me get started. Some of this has already been covered in previous talks. In particular, Neil talked about a lot of stuff related to what I'm going to present. So I'll just do a quick review of why we might be doing this search. So it starts a couple years ago. We find unexpected features in the cosmic ray electron and positron spectra measured at Earth. So this is the Pamela positron fraction plot. So positron fraction is a function of energy, and these red points here show an unexpected rise in the spectrum. And this is, by the way, calculated from secondary positron fraction only. That's compared to a conventional model. And then ADEC reports an interesting bump in the electron plus positron spectrum. Following that, Fermi goes out and measures the same thing and doesn't see that same prominent bump, but does see sort of a rise here that would seem to disagree with a conventional model for what the electron plus positron spectrum should look like. And then more recently, as already has been mentioned, Fermi has made an independent measure of the positron fraction and basically confirms the Pamela result and in fact extends it to higher energies. So we see that the positron fraction continues to rise, even above 100 GeV. So this, of course, makes theorists wonder, could this be hints of a dark matter signal? So as you all know, there was a lot of interest in this in the years following this, those experimental results. The main features I want to point out are that if you want to explain these cosmic ray results with dark matter, you generically want to work with leptophilic models, and you want to have large annihilation cross-section. So for example, you could use a Sommerfeld model for that. However, there are also some very, very reasonable non-dark matter, non-exotic explanations for these spectra. In particular, people have pointed out that nearby pulsars could produce both the features in the positron and the positron plus electron spectra. These are just two plots from Profumo and also from Yuxel et al., showing that Gamingo, for example, could produce the necessary extra flux of positrons or electrons plus positrons to accommodate the data. So we have some other explanations. It's not clear that we know how to discriminate them. But if I want to go back to the dark matter question, immediately people recognize that there are going to be constraints on dark matter explanations of this data. In particular, they focus on using the fact that you're injecting a lot of charged leptons through dark matter annihilation, often in very interesting environments that produce a lot of other signals, and also that you're going to use very large annihilation cross-sections. So these constraints, the top panel is just showing what happens. Basically, if you consider the fact that we have a dark matter halo, and if locally you want to have a lot of positrons or electrons plus positrons coming from dark matter annihilation, if you extrapolate that in towards the galactic center, then you're going to have a lot of annihilation happening at the galactic center, particularly with a very large annihilation cross-section. So when you start injecting all these charged leptons, you end up with a variety of constraints. Particularly directly from gamma rays, you can use continuum, and this is FSR, I believe, from this paper showing the constraints in pink? No. I believe it's, if these lines back here are showing the constraints you would get from the galactic center. This is, and then the stronger constraints here are from radio emission that you would get, the synchrotron emission from the charged particles you're injecting. And the radio constraints are actually quite strong. And of course, this is the region showing Pamela, and this is where Fermi also would overlap with that. In the inner galaxy, you also get constraints from the inverse Compton scattering of all the charged leptons that you're dumping in. There's a lot of starlight around there, so you're going to get a lot more gamma rays as well, and these are showing constraints you would get using the EGRET data and then more recently with the Fermi data. And this pretty much would rule out for most models almost all of the parameter space compatible with both the Fermi electron plus positron measurement as well as Pamela. In addition, you get constraints from the diffuse gamma ray background. If you then consider not just in the Milky Way, we're having dark matter annihilation, but in every structure throughout the universe. This figure here from Profumo and Deltima is showing what would happen if you have all this charged leptons being dumped in the early universe as well, all throughout, and what it would look like for the extragalactic gamma ray background. In particular, if you inverse Compton upscatter the CMB at high redshifts, you're going to get this nice bump here. And I believe this is the FSR emission. So this is showing measurements of the isotropic gamma ray background spectrum. And this is what some models would look like that would fit the Fermi and Pamela cosmic ray data. On this side, I'm showing what happens actually from Milky Way halos, Milky Way subhalos. So in our own galaxy, what contribution you would get to the high latitude gamma ray emission. This is work I did with Matt Kistler at Ohio State. And basically, we're just showing that the inverse Compton emission from dumping all these charged leptons into our own Milky Way halo would produce a very large signal compared to the measured gamma ray background. I also want to mention, see also these other papers. I know there's a more recent paper that considered this and showed there's a lot of, I guess, more wiggle room here. I don't want to go into too much detail about that. But so we have dark matter models that might be able to explain the cosmic ray data, but there's also a variety of constraints that might apply to those. Not going to talk about this because Doug already talked about it. This is additional constraints in these models from the CMB, and I guess pretty soon we'll have another paper talking about a very similar subject. Okay, so to move right into the subject of the talk, really. So Schuster et al. Looked at or discussed two scenarios in which we might expect some of these models to produce an observable cosmic ray electron flux from the sun. And this is the motivation for the analysis we did in Fermi. So to very briefly summarize them, the first one I'm going to call the intermediate state scenario. And this is where you have dark matter, is captured by the sun in the usual way, sinks to the center, annihilates into some sort of intermediate state phi that manages to escape the sun and then decays to cosmic ray electrons outside the surface of the sun. Those cosmic ray electrons are then observable potentially by Fermi. And that's sort of what's supposed to be shown here, your standard scenario for WIMP being captured by the sun, sinking to the center. The difference is that you have this intermediate state phi allowing the electrons to escape. If you didn't have the intermediate state, then they would just get stuck in the center of the sun and you would not have an observable flux. That's the usual expectation. So the alternative scenario that they considered is sort of inelastic dark matter. In this case, you have the fact that inelastic dark matter doesn't end up sinking to the core. If it gets captured, you can have the case where it cannot continue scattering and losing energy. It doesn't have enough energy to sort of hit that threshold. So instead, it gets captured in these very large orbits. And you can accumulate a non-negligible amount of this outside the surface of the sun, which can then annihilate directly to cosmic ray electrons. So that's what's being shown here. And you're looking for annihilations that are happening outside the surface of the sun. So from these two scenarios, within Fermi, we decided to do an analysis looking for a cosmic ray electron signal from the sun to see what whether or not we could detect something or alternatively constrain these models. So Fermi is a gamma ray space telescope. It, however, also is very good at detecting electrons and positrons, as you've probably already gathered since they've been publishing results on cosmic rays. It is a pair production detector. So basically, you have a particle comes in, it interacts, hopefully, in the silicon trackers. It produces a shower that is then sort of tracked to the trackers and ends up in the calorimeter. So you can measure the energy of each individual event, and you can measure the arrival direction by reconstructing the shower. This works equally well for gamma rays and electrons and positrons. However, we're pretty able to identify charged particle events due to an anti-coincidence detector on the outside. We also get an enormous number of charged particle events, so many that I don't believe even all of them are sent down to Earth from the spacecraft. So we have very large statistics on cosmic rays. And so we can obviously do science with these. I should mention we cannot, in general, identify the charge of an individual event, although if you're very clever and you use the Earth's magnetic field, which has been done recently to do this comparison with the Pamela positron fraction, you can. However, the data you can use for that is actually quite limited because you need to look at the Earth's limb, which is not what Fermi does most of the time. So the analysis I'm talking about does not distinguish between electron and positron events. We're just looking at the total flux of cosmic ray electrons and positrons. Here's the usual pictures. You can see how big Fermi is, and this is the person. So it's in space. It's not enormous. All right. So for this analysis, we use pretty much all the cosmic ray electron events above 60 GeV from the first year of operation. This is the same set of events that we use for the cosmic ray electron anisotropy paper, if you're familiar with that. They look for anisotropies in the cosmic ray electron events. We basically use this limit of 60 GeV because below that we have to worry about a lot of things like for example, cosmic rays being affected by the Earth's magnetic fields or the solar magnetic fields as they propagate. So 60 GeV is sort of a good limit, lower limit for us to start this analysis if we're looking for something that's directional. I can talk more about why it is or what sort of uncertainties we expect in the directionality of the events later if anyone has any questions. So, What?
What's the radius of the orbit of Fermi?
The
how
radius
high,
of
how high is Fermi?
Oh, geez, I don't know that. Is there a really a question that I can answer, maybe?
I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about the you know, Earth's magnetic fields and, you know, how much you have to worry about them. I was just trying to get a better sense of that and whether 60 GeV is really, even is that enough that you can, you know, start ignoring the Earth's magnetic
field? I think at 60 GeV, the Earth's magnetic field is not really an issue. I think it was the solar magnetic field we were more worried about. No, maybe I have that backwards. In any case, we did a simulation to see what would happen, and basically we don't see, basically the deflections for the events are something like 3 degrees per, 300? Let's say, at worst case, it's maybe like 3 degrees, and at best case, sorry, that's the best case, and at the worst case, we're looking at maybe 10 or 20 degrees based on the simulation we did. Now, we don't, this does vary as you go in the orbit, so depending on the Earth's magnetic field, we don't actually take each event and figure out where it was in the Earth's magnetic field at the time it was detected. We take an average of what the dispersion is. So we could actually do a little bit better, but given the other uncertainties in the calculation, it didn't seem to be worthwhile to tag each individual event. So typical uncertainty in the position of arrival events due to magnetic fields and things like that is somewhere between like 3 and 20 degrees. The analysis we're going to look actually at a 30-degree ROI around the sun, and bigger as well. Okay, so does that answer the question that you were getting at? There's more details in the paper about the simulation and all that, and using the geomagnetic field reference model and things like that. Okay, so we do the analysis in ecliptic coordinates, and we use a reference frame that's centered on the sun. I just point this out because there was another anisotropic research done that was done in galactic coordinates. So the fact that they did not find anisotropies in galactic coordinates does not necessarily imply that we are not going to find them if we look in a sun-centered system. Okay, we use 3 approaches to search for a flux excess from the sun. The first is a flux asymmetry search. We basically have a sun, and then we define a fake sun in the opposite direction in the sky. And we simply compare the flux from the two ROIs, one on the fake sun and one on the real sun. The second one is we do a comparison with an isotropic flux. This is using a technique, an event shuffling technique, to determine what an isotropic background would look like. In particular, we basically take the events in the LAT reference frame and we swap the arrival times of events. So, or rather, we can swap the events. It's equivalent to swap the time or swap the events and instrument coordinates, which means that they get randomized on the sky because the instrument is always moving. What that does is it shows you what the sky would look like if it genuinely were isotropic, an isotropic flux that was hitting it. And this basically allows us to define how big an isotropic flux would be in a way that's sort of independent from taking a particular chunk of sky. It also means you don't have to independently calculate the exposure of the instrument. This is another way of figuring that out, and that's convenient because we don't have exposure maps for the cosmic ray electron data set, unlike the gamma rays. And finally, anyone who knows me knows I can't give a talk without talking about angular power spectra, so we also did a spherical harmonics analysis, and this is looking for flux variations correlated with any sky direction rather than just the sun's sky direction, and on different angular scales. This is convenient because, for example, the sun's Parker spiral magnetic field shape can cause potentially the situation that a flux from the sun might appear to be offset from the sun by maybe even a couple tens of degrees. So it's nice to do this because it means that we're not focusing only on a particular point in the sky. Okay, so the results we get. From the flux asymmetry, this is comparing the real versus the fake sun in the opposite position. On the left, I'm showing the flux difference. This is E cubed, the NDE, basically. And this is energy on this axis. Zero is right around here, so you see the points are pretty much scattered around zero. On the right side, we have flux upper limits with 1, 2, and 3 sigma confidence level intervals. So you can see, as we go to higher energies, we're getting weaker limits, and that's simply due to decreasing statistics. So, however, the important thing is that no flux excess is detected in any energy bin greater than 3 sigma. We don't find any significant excess from the direction of the sun. This is, you know, interesting in the sense that it means we don't find anything from dark matter models, and of course we don't have any astrophysical expectation for a cosmic ray electron flux from the sun at these energies. Okay, if we then do the comparison with the isotropic flux, which was determined by the shuffling technique, we get essentially the same results. And these are all evaluated in an ROI of 30 degrees, I should mention that. We did the same analysis for larger ROIs, and the limits only weakened slightly. So basically, again, we're seeing error bars blow up at high energies, but as we heard about earlier, the low energy end is, or the low mass end, low energy end is what's going to be really interesting for the dark matter models anyway. Okay, and finally we have the spherical harmonics analysis. We look at the fluctuation angular power spectrum of the events. So we're doing this angular power spectrum of the flux in units of the mean flux. This has to do with the fact that we can't independently calculate the exposure we can do it in other ways, but for the purpose of determining whether or not we have a statistically significant deviation, this was sufficient. So what we see is we're taking the power spectrum minus the shot noise level. So zero is sort of the expectation here, and the curves indicate the 3 and 5 sigma limits on the probability distribution for the shot noise. So basically, we'd have to see some points in outside of these lines to see anything significant, and we don't see anything near that. We don't even have a 3 sigma detection of angular power at these multipoles. We're only focusing on the fairly large angular scales here. This has a lot to do with the fact that our individual event resolution is fairly poor, so it doesn't make sense to look for degree angular scale anisotropies. So basically up to multipoles of about 20, we're not seeing anything in the angular power spectrum.
For a higher energy cutoff, like 200 or something?
We did. Yeah, sorry. This is all the events above 60 GeV, so this is not shown in the other ones I was showing in different energy bins. This is everything above 60. We did it above several different ones that's in the paper. We still don't see anything significant in any of them. Okay. So I don't want to go into too much more details about the experimental analysis, but I can answer some questions about it if you're curious. The main thing is, what does this mean for dark matter models? So we did then is we calculate the expected solar cosmic ray electron fluxes from these various dark matter models, and then we're going to compare them with the experimental results. So I realize that several of the people in this room have worked out this calculation, and I basically followed what they did in then working it out myself. So just putting that out there, if you want to see someone who did it in great detail, you could check out some of these references. Okay, so to give some more details about the scenario, as I mentioned, we have dark matter that's captured by the sun via elastic scattering. This is the standard scenario for solar capture of dark matter particles, sinks to the center and annihilates. Okay, it annihilates then to a new light scalar, phi, and then we're going to have that decay to an electron and positron pair. We assume that the phi have mass less than a few GeV, while the dark matter has a much larger mass, so we end up with relativistic phi, and they can escape easily. So they escape before decaying, and then we can observe the cosmic ray electrons, and as we heard, we've heard some of this stuff. The addition of this new light scalar is related to mechanisms for Sommerfeld enhancement and things like that, and in particular, this class of models being considered to explain the observed excesses in cosmic ray electrons by Pamela and Attic and Fermi. So that's sort of the motivation for this. And I want to mention all the results I'm presenting rely on a dark matter particle that annihilates and produces a final state with electrons. You could certainly have these models where they produce a final state that's not electrons, and this analysis would not constrain that at all. However, it's considering the motivations for constructing these models and the experimental data we want to explain, it does make sense to consider ones that do annihilate directly to electrons. Sure.
Can you specify scale a bit about, like, could it be a light factor? Do you just need to get the lifetime longer?
No, I suppose, I mean,
Yeah, I think
it's
just getting
more
charged.
Okay. You guys worked out the theory, so as long as it still produces my electrons, I'd be happy to, yes.
Yeah,
I
this particular analysis, but
okay,
it's just...
Okay. Okay, however, there's also existing gamma ray constraints on this particular scenario, and this comes from the fact that you get FSR every time you make these charged lepton final states here. So every once in a while, a photon pops out too, and we can use that. We can use observations of the sun and gamma rays to constrain these models as well. So this has already been done. Schuster et al., but some other authors have also considered this situation. They've done this for EGRET data, Milagro data, and Fermilat data on gamma rays from the sun, although it only goes up to about 10 GeV. So if we had a solar spectrum that went higher, we actually might be able to do a bit better. So these are basically showing constraints on the annihilation rate of dark matter outside the sun. And as a function of dark matter mass. So they end up being pretty flat on this plot, and we're going to be most interested in dark matter masses that are fairly small. So right now Fermi is doing, the Fermi solar data is doing the best, but as I said, if we had a higher energy solar spectrum, we might be able to do a bit better. Okay, I'm going to refer back to that and want to compare our constraints to that as well. Okay, so how do we get the flux from this scenario? just a big messy equation. I just want to point out we're going to integrate along the line of sight. We have a term that is the decay rate of the phi per unit volume, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. We have the angular distribution of the cosmic ray electrons, and then we have a delta function to select the observed energy of the cosmic ray electrons. So this calculation requires that we have some particular inputs about the dark matter. For the capture rate, we simply use dark CC to calculate the standard solar capture rate. As you all know, this is proportional to the elastic scattering cross section and depends on the particle mass. And then L here is the decay length of the phi, and this is set by the lifetime of the phi and its energy. For reference, we're going to use a phi mass of 1 GeV. It turns out our results are very insensitive to this, basically up to phi of about 10 GeV, and we went down to about 0.1 GeV, and we don't see much of a difference. But I will show the reference ones for 1 GeV. Okay, so the limits that we find. So we looked at spin-dependent scattering and spin-independent scattering. This just depends on how we calculate our capture rate. So the figure on the left is showing this for both figures show for three different decay lengths, so 5AU, 1AU, and 0.1AU. So this is basically saying typically how far are they going to get out of the sun before they decay. If they get too far, then it's going to weaken your signal because you won't have it in your ROI. If they don't go far enough, then you don't get a lot of them. Anyway, it turns out that our best limits are coming from the ones with the shortest decay length, 0.1 AU.
Shape of these limits?
So this is coming from the fact that the limits that were obtained in the experimental analysis are jagged. And basically all I'm doing is calculating theoretical flux for those and then taking them. And what's happening at each jagged point is the energy bin that is setting the best limit is changing. So I've taken the flux in all the energy bins and then just pick the best one of each mass. And this is a continuum flux, so it turns out that the jagged lines are going to stay pretty jagged because it's continuum. It doesn't make that much of a difference if you include like the energy dispersion of the instrument, just because it's a fairly smooth energy spectrum.
But is there something about the experiment that is continuous with energy, or?
No. A lot of our uncertainties are set by statistics. I don't really have a good answer to why it is they're so jagged. You saw them in the previous plots. It could have to do with, you know, maybe we have a little bit more sensitivity in some parts of the sky than others, and, you know, different selection cuts that were made in this analysis. I don't really have a good answer. I mean, it's in the same way that, you know, if you look at, for example, the extragalactic gamma ray background spectrum. You know, it's not perfectly smooth. There's a little bit of jaggedness there, and I guess it comes from the uncertainties in how they've selected their data and analyzed it. That's where they come from in these plots.
So can I ask you, why are spin dependent and spin independent different? Is that just because you have so many protons?
I'm sorry.
Why are the limits on the spin-independent stronger than on the spin-independent cross-section? Is it just because you have a lot of protons?
It's just from the capture rate.
Sorry.
But the difference in them is just due to the capture rate by the sun. So,
Couldn't read the numbers.
Sorry, they're very small, I know.
Read the scale.
But they're way below the direct detection limits, but of course this assumes that we're annihilating to cosmic ray electrons only. In the spin independent, we get basically the same results, just scaled by the capture rate for the spin independent cross sections. The solar capture, I guess it occurred by about 3 orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
And it's just the solar capture rate for spin independent scattering is much, I'm going to say this backwards. The solar capture rate is much larger for spin independent scattering than spin dependent. Or did I say that backwards? No? There's nothing about the physics, about the model at all. The only thing that's changing the two of these things is the solar capture rate.
If you have a big spin independent, then you can scatter out with iron, and if you're heavy, then you can lose energy to iron and get trapped, but you won't lose a lot of energy to a proton.
I see. So is the iron is important?
Yeah.
So, two questions. I didn't understand your explanation of the... So L is a path length before it decays?
Yeah.
Because I would have thought that if that went to zero, you wouldn't escape at all, and your electron would just be captured inside the sun.
Yeah, so we've only chosen values that are interesting for this analysis. So basically, if we went So, I mean, 0.1 AU is still quite a bit outside the surface of the sun. So, yeah, if we went too small, then yes, our signal would go to zero very quickly.
Okay, also, they're still, okay.
What we're doing is we're making it so that they, I mean, if I have, like, if I have the sun and they're coming out, I'm trying to get a lot of them right here on the surface, just outside the surface of the sun, so I'm trying to get them very concentrated near the sun, but not in the sun, and I don't want them to go too far because then they're outside of my ROI.
Okay, so the other thing is, what are you assuming about where the dark matter is starting? So, I mean, if I remember right, you can put up a dark matter sphere, a thermal sphere inside the sun.
Yeah, so this one we made the approximation that they sink all the way to the core of the sun, and that, I think, is a reasonable approximation for standard elastic scattering.
Okay.
I mean, there's a thermal distribution, but for the most part, it's the distance we assume is traveling is, you know, the radius of the sun.
Okay.
So that minimum one is 20 solar radii.
What?
Right. That's 20 solar radii, that minimum one.
Yeah, the radius of the sun is a 200th of an AU.
Okay.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, so it's traveling quite a bit out.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have to worry about planets kicking?
We did the standard calculation. We didn't throw in like Jupiter or anything like that. We did
standard. There's like some within like 5 AU, you have several planets. I don't know if
we didn't modify the velocity distribution of the dark matter particles. We used a standard Maxwellian velocity distribution in Dark Susie. If you're, I mean, and in this case,
you're not going to have very many scatterings with those planets, I guess.
No, and in the elastic case, especially, I mean, we expect that they would, once they're scattering inside the sun, they're very quickly going to lose energy and sink to the center.
Okay.
So it's a very standard picture, nothing fancy going on in it. Yeah.
These limits must just come from dominated by the ones, like ones that are 1 and 5 AU. Like 5 AU must just be dominated by the small fractions that are actually decaying before they get to us, right?
Yeah. I mean, they get weak pretty fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see it's already changed by 2
or
9.
It should just fall like 1 over L or something. Like
yeah, I mean, I think we took this range, but I think maybe Schuster used 5 AU in their paper, so
just as sort of
a bound. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, so we could go smaller than 0.1 and we would get slightly better limits, and eventually we would get nothing. So, okay, questions about this before I go to the other scenario? Okay. This one actually might be more interesting for this crowd. This is what happens in the inelastic case. Okay, so just to be concrete, we assume that dark matter is captured by inelastic scattering with nuclear ions in the sun, so it's transitioning to an excited state. However, this can only occur if the dark matter has sufficient energy. So here's some equations basically showing what the mass splitting has to be between the excited state and the non-excited state. We're typically assuming this to be about 100 keV. This is what's relevant for these direct detection experiments, in particular if you want to explain CDMS and Dama-Libra. Okay, so what happens then, as I mentioned, is after only a few scatterings, the dark matter doesn't have enough energy to continue scattering inelastically, and so it can't sink to the core, and instead it stays in these fairly large orbits out here. So it's actually going to annihilate outside the sun. And it was shown that a non-negligible fraction of the dark matter can be accumulated outside the sun. In the standard scenario, you don't expect any significant amount of the distribution of captured dark matter particles to be outside the surface. So, what did I mention about this? Okay, yeah, so these models are interesting because they could potentially explain these direct detection results. All right, so how do we calculate this? The isotropic flux is just given by the annihilation rate divided, you know, so the standard flux calculation here. The important thing is that we need to know how much of the dark matter was actually annihilating outside the sun. So the fraction, so basically the annihilation rate outside is given by the fraction of the dark matter outside at any given moment times the total annihilation rate. And we're going to assume equilibrium. And then we take F out because it was calculated by Schuster et al. So basically they did a simulation to see what fraction of the captured dark matter particles in the scenario would be remaining outside the surface of the sun, what fraction would be in. Normally you assume they're basically all at the center, but in fact it turns out there's a non-negligible, it's a very small amount in most cases, but non-negligible amount outside. In addition, the capture rate for these particles was calculated also by Nusanov et al. And Manon et al., so we used the one from Nusanov et al., I believe, in this paper. So we didn't recalculate all of these things. We take from the literature the calculation of F out and also of the capture rate. We assume the dark matter is annihilating at rest, so we have a monoenergetic cosmic ray electron flux with the energy at the mass of the dark matter particle. And in this scenario, but not in the previous one, we specifically account for the energy resolution of the lat, since we expect that the limits for masses near the energy bin edges are going to be weakened by spreading the signal over multiple energy bins. And the typical lat energy resolution at these energies is something like 15%, give or take a bit. So that's a non-negligible amount given the size of the energy bins. Okay, so this is sort of the experimental result that's relevant. This is from the CDMS collaboration analysis, looking at what their constraints on IDM models are. This is for a mass splitting of 120 keV. So the yellow regions show the Dama-Libra allowed parameter space for IDM. And CDMS is showing with the black solid line and the red dashed line their exclusion curves. So this is nucleon scattering cross-section, and this is the Wnt mass here. So what's interesting, though, is what they didn't exclude, which is basically masses below about 100 GeV and cross-sections of about 10 to the minus 39, 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared. So what limits do we find? So for this scenario, limits we obtain are actually significantly below the significantly stronger than the CDMS limits. In particular, we can go down to about 70 GeV in dark matter mass. So this is the 95% confidence level exclusions, and we get down to somewhere between 10 to the minus 41 and 10 to the minus 42, depending on the chosen mass splitting. This is basically the range of mass splitting that could potentially reconcile the results of CDMS and Dama-Libra. So this is sort of exciting because we see that, we basically, for the cosmic ray electron final state, we can pretty much exclude almost all of the remaining parameter space for IDM to explain these experiments. Okay, so the summary, again, all of these results only apply if I assume dark matter annihilates to electrons. If it annihilates to something else, I don't necessarily have anything to say about that from this particular analysis. So our constraints on the dark matter nucleon elastic scattering cross-section correspond to significantly stronger bounds on the rate of decay outside the sun than existing constraints on the associated FSR emission from solar gamma ray data. In addition, for the IDM models, we can exclude all the parameter space for masses above about 70 GeV that could reconcile those two experiments for this annihilation channel. Okay, any questions? Well, there's a lot more data. I think at this point we're to some degree systematics limited. For example, like converting the counts to fluxes, there's an uncertainty on that. In particular, it's not the sort of thing that sure, and we quote fractional upper limits. Yeah. So that's something. But if you want to know an absolute flux and compare that to an actual dark matter model, then you
how much better is your fractional limit going to get?
It's pretty good right now.
Yeah, but you let's suppose you want to be like really excited and once in a while, like you had a couple of bins like right up at a TDE,
yeah.
Right? Those seem kind of up, and you're like, oh, I wonder if those could stay up if your air bars got better. Because they aren't interesting now, but obviously if they stayed up.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, there's a lot more statistics one could use, and if you don't care about converting it to an actual flux, you could certainly improve those. You could also do the tracking each individual event in the Earth's magnetic field to do a much better directional analysis. So we're taking 30 degrees around the sun if you want, or we're doing all sky for the angular power spectrum analysis. If you could track each event back to maybe more like a few degrees of where it really came from, as opposed to saying, somewhere between 3 and 20 degrees, you could probably do a lot better. At this point, yeah, it wasn't something that went into this analysis, but I guess it could be done. And there is more data in the can now, so one could do that.
Other question? There might be an interesting subsidiary effect from these five particles decaying. I estimate they're decaying around 10 to the minus 2 seconds, which is about 5 MeV, which is about when neutrinos were decoupling. So could be that their decays in the early universe are actually suppressing the density of neutrinos. And so there might be some interplay with CMB, with cosmology here.
That's an interesting point. I'm going to bounce that to the theorists who constructed these models and ask what they think. Have you worked out?
One second. Well, let's see. The energy density in those things had better be pretty low, right? So the energy, so I think that you're really just talking about a constraint on the total energy density of these particles at that point in the universe, first and foremost, right? So as long as you're significantly less than the energy density of relativistic degree of freedom, I think that it probably won't have that big of an impact. But if you're comparable to the energy,
no, but these things are GeV particles that are surviving down to 5 MeV, so they could very well be dominating at that temperature.
Yeah, they stay in, they can annihilate through conversion into photons, right, by scattering off of electrons. So they can actually still continue to deplete themselves pretty efficiently after that. I don't remember for this particular path length, at what point that process stops, but
So what I think Jim is actually talking about an entropy producing scenario, right?
Yeah.
Where you have it.
But
thereby you deplete the neutrinos and you can repopulate. Because you want to have a lower neutrino temperature.
I don't want it, but it seems like that's a danger.
I don't quite see the lower neutrino temperature. I see the entropy production.
If you're dumping in entropy after the neutrinos have decoupled.
In that respect.
But aren't there a million or a billion photons for every phi?
Yeah.
Even if the phis were in.
Yeah. This is just a question about how. The only question is whether or not the population, the energy density of these things is particularly high at that point, which is just a question of how long they stay in equilibrium. But this mixing parameter is. It's right, the diagram's pretty easy, right? It's just. Well, for the vector case, I know how to calculate it. For the scalar case, it's trickier. Yeah. The scalar case is trickier.
Other questions for Jennifer?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we don't have... Okay, so we can continue this afterwards. So according to that clock,